The only way to solve the drug problem is through toughness. When I was in China, I said, Mr. President, do you have a drug problem? No, 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 we do not. I said, what do you attribute that to? Well, the death penalty. So, you're killing our kids. They're killing our kids. They're killing our kids. They're killing our families. They're killing our workers.
Congratulations, America. That is your president, Donald Trump, speaking in Western Pennsylvania on Friday about any number of topics, which we'll get to later. I am Matt Welch. You're listening to the Reason Podcast Monday edition, in which we talk to the editorial brain trust of the 50th anniversary having Reason magazine and all its offshoots. I am joined by Catherine Mangu Ward, Peter Suderman, and Nick Gillespie. Everybody in perfect three-part harmony. Say hi, Matt.
Hi, Matt.
Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Jesus Christ, Suderman, you can't do anything right. So today on this fine Monday, and again, thank you for joining us. And while we're in the thanking part, please go and subscribe to us on iTunes already and leave a review, preferably about Peter Suderman's singing abilities, let alone cocktail making abilities and whatnot. So we're going to talk about President Trump's unique ideas about what China can teach us about drug policy a little bit later on, because it has more implications than just a mere laugh line at a Trump rally. But we're going to get to some other stuff, too, including his surprising Friday drop that, hey, we might be talking to North Korea in person sometime in the next couple of months. We're also going to talk about the trade war now that we have it. And our usual whatcha consuming stuff at the end here. But let's start with North Korea, since it feels like that was like 4 weeks ago already. We've gone through a lot of different news cycles since then. But on Friday, the president announced, was it Friday or was it Thursday? Late, recently, announced that, or actually I should say the South Korea representative on the White House lawn, announced that the U.S. has agreed to have a face-to-face discussions with Kim Jong-un here. And predictably, a lot of people freaked out because it's Trump and it's because it's North Korea. Just kind of as an opening gut check here, Nick Gillespie, how are you liking President Trump's North Korea diplomacy?
I'm all in favor of it. You know, this is one of the things that is great to watch the establishment, the deep state, whatever you want to call it, the random chattering heads all over the internet freaking out about this stuff. But it's like, look, we have a perfectly failed policy with North Korea since the Korean War. To the extent that we've contained them, it's been expensive and kind of stupid at our expense. When you have major regional powers that could contain it, do something different. And it's far from clear what will happen, because at this point, it's worth it's worth underscoring that Trump said he is interested in sitting down and meeting with Kim Jong-un. Whether that happens is a totally different story.
Catherine, are we just being libertarian nihilists here, saying nothing works, man? So let's just do the crazy thing. Do our more world weary think tank centrists in the world who are busy rending garments there, do they have a point about our naivete when we greet this type of news with something like a shrug emoji?
I am not anti-shruggy. I think sometimes it's okay to be a libertarian nihilist, but I think the part of that that's right is one single meeting is not, in fact, going to make or break us. The idea that there are these sort of breaking points, these world historical events, and what two great men say in the meeting matters is typically a sort of narrative exaggeration. There is less at stake if those two get together in a room than the coverage might lead you to believe.
Suderman, you object to everything on process reasons, because that's who you are. It's worth pointing out that I think on Tuesday, Mike Pence, who I believe is the vice president, said something like, we're not going to meet with those guys. Are you kidding? Wednesday, Rex Tillerson says something similar, not unless there's a bunch of concessions. And by Thursday evening, the president is saying, sure, why not here? Are you alarmed by the way that this happened in terms of the normal administration of Trump events?
Frankly, I'm alarmed by the process that led to this question. And really, that's what I want to talk about before we get into the North Korea part. No, yes, you are correct. I think that they got the process wrong here. I am not deeply alarmed by the prospect of them talking. I think that all else being equal, talking is a good thing to do. And in the short term, it probably almost certainly reduces the risk of armed conflict between North Korea and the United States or North Korea and anywhere else.
Yeah.
And so at least in the short term, it's a good thing. But I want to let's talk about the process here, because typically what you do with high level meetings between foreign leaders like this is you set it up in advance so that everybody basically knows what they're going after and what they're trying to get going in. And so the two presidents talking is the last step in a long process that starts well in advance, in which both sides kind of send signals and they let each other know, well, here's where I'm at. Okay, well, here's where we're at. This is what this sort of the main point of this conversation is going to be. And the reason that you want to do that is because when you put Kim Jong-un and Trump in a room together, those guys can't make concessions to each other in the way that low-level negotiators can, working you sort of off the record, working in rooms that are, you know, where people aren't are quieter, sort of where stuff is not going to get out. And so those guys can't sort of take the risks, can't make the sorts of negotiating moves that you would want to see from low-level negotiators happening first. And so in this case, I think, like I said, that it is, all else being equal, a good thing. On the other hand, I think they kind of got it backwards, and I think they have created a situation in which the negotiations here are less likely to be productive than if they had gone about this in a slower and more methodical
likely to
way.
Be productive compared to, I don't know, like every other North Korean set of talks. It's worth taking a step back, and I'm mindful, Matt, I think you wrote a good piece about the North Korean talks where you said, you know, maybe this is okay. And there's a wide variety of people, including, I guess, Tom Nichols, who read what I thought was an excellent book called The Death of Expertise, but he was, you know, worried about this. And he's an actual foreign policy, you know, political science guy and everything like that. And there's all of this fear, all of this worry, which seems to me a little bit misplaced, because we are coming out of, in the 21st century, an uninterrupted set of absolute disasters in foreign policy. And all of the wise people are saying what we should be doing is exactly what we have been doing since 2000, which has failed spectacularly and led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, directly as a result and indirectly as a result of American foreign policy. I'm not worried about Trump sitting down with Kim Jong-un. I mean, it is clearly, it's like, you know, Charlie meeting Algernon in Flowers from Algernon here. We're not talking about anything, you know, that's, you know, nobody is going to be lighting up the world with the brain power at this confab, much less North Korea. But, you know, like, for God's sake.
Lighting up the world is an amazing choice of words.
Yeah, but
there.
It's even the idea of like, oh, we don't want to get into an armed conflict with North Korea. We won't. You know, because first off, North Korea has nothing that can reach America. And for all of the talk, when you look at, oh, they've thrown out missiles, they've got nukes now, et cetera. It's like they can't come anywhere close
to us.
Sure,
they have things. They have nuclear weapons that could reach Seoul, that could reach South Korea.
Yeah, I know. And maybe, it's time for Seoul and Japan and China. And it's important to remember that North Korea is a complete client state of China. Everything that happens in North Korea happens because the Chinese allow it. Let them deal with it. And that's not being isolationist. It's actually acknowledging that America doesn't control the world, nor should it try to. And we need something different. And we're not going to get something different if we do everything exactly the same way that we've done that has led to major disasters. And just as a parting shot, you know, the great diplomatic moment, at least in Matt and my life, because we're older than you guys, was when Reagan went off script in Reykjavik and with Gorbachev. And did what everybody told him not to do and which hadn't been discussed. And he talked about actually disarming nukes. And that was one of the main triumphs in 20th century diplomacy. And it helped lead and accelerate the end and the demise of the Soviet Union. So
and
sometimes
at the time,
improv
it's worth,
is good and was seen as a disaster.
Yes, exactly. At the time, it was greeted with not exactly the same hostility, but similar hostility, and in some cases from the same damn people. at the time that it was weak, that it was rash, and all of these things. They ended up kind of, you know, the end game of Reykjavik wasn't exactly as Reagan put it in the meeting. It was sanded down on the edges or whatever. But I think Nick is absolutely right. It was a totally important moment that we actually benefited from that. And the kind of sense of that there's this process and there's a credibility and legitimacy. I think when people, it's kind of like a, I had an old editor who used to say, for every time you have an adjective, replace it with a number. Catherine obviously loves that concept. But we were at is it a business journal? But I feel like that in foreign policy, anytime you hear the word legitimacy or credibility or legitimizing and these types of things or, you know, assertiveness or all that, it's kind of vaporware. It's actually kind of, a fifth grader trying to say that this park bench is mine, not yours. It's not really an approach to foreign policy. And Peter, you're going to jump in on Nick's face.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's virtues to improvisation. And I think the foreign policy community has just obviously failed in so many ways for decades now. I don't think there's any question about that. But, you know, we're going to talk about Donald Trump's kind of campaign trail style speech in Pennsylvania a little later, in which he called, basically, he's like, wouldn't it be great if we solved our drug problem by executing drug dealers? This is a guy who, as president of the United States, spends a bunch of his time tweeting Fox and Friends, for goodness sake. This is not like, I mean, it's do you trust Donald Trump to have whose whole approach to the world is aggression, dominance, lying, and like not in any way kind of caring about the consequences of his actions to other people? Do you think that Donald Trump should be the point person for this and is probably going to make good, smart, improvisational? That's the word I'm looking for. Improvisational moves in this sort of situation. And so the risk here isn't talking to North Korea. Like I said, I think all else being equal, we should be talking to them. The risk is in Donald Trump deciding unilaterally to do this one afternoon, just like he decided with
then,
the tariffs.
Catherine, what,
we all
wait,
hate.
But
we're
like, the downside.
He decides what?
Like, what thing does he decide that hurts us at that moment, Peter?
God knows. That's the problem, is that he's totally unpredictable.
This way lies nihilism.
He's an aggressive, bullying idiot.
This way lies nihilism. We have this president. It's not my fault. It might be Nick's fault, but it's not my fault that we have this president.
I take full responsibility for that. And but I don't think this is the time to engage in recrimination.
Okay, now we're getting somewhere.
I'll be damned if I'm going to stand by while Peter is denouncing Steve Doocy and Brian Kilmeade on Fox and Friends. You know, these guys, they are like William Leibniz and Isaac Newton of morning TV.
The
and
most
I realize
important
they also
presidential
haven't been on the show
advisors,
in like years,
really.
Catherine.
The thing, though, is that we can't simultaneously pursue the two things that we're talking about here. It can't be, all right, let's say that conversation is good and we just want to get out there and engage. And, you know, if Trump extemporaneously, you know, make some kind of deal, like how bad could it possibly be? That's one approach. The other approach is this isn't fundamentally a U.S. issue. It should be something that's dealt with by China. Those two things can't simultaneously happen. As long as the U.S. is a dominant player and as long as Trump demonstrates intense yet sporadic interest in the region and in North Korea in particular, it would be insane for China to try and own this issue, to take it over, to be the dominant superpower, because they're just going to get big-footed by Donald Trump.
I think there is one wisdom in there, Catherine, to half agree and then half dispute. The wisdom is, and my worry is now, Trump on the campaign trail and on in Republican debates and things like that was probably the least hawkish of everybody towards North Korea, given an opportunity to say, you know, would you launch a preemptive strike to keep them from testing missiles, on the launch pad? And this seemed to be a normal question from Arthur Raditz. He's like, no, I wouldn't. I would rule that out, actually. And so he talked a lot and constantly and consistently about that devolution in the Nick Gillespie style of like, it's their problem and let's get China to solve it and this kind of stuff. So that, I think, is a good instinct. And it is also good that this proposed meeting came out as a result of what? A meeting between South Korea and North Korea, who are ultimately the people who are going to have to sort this one out. So that's good. Then what's bad, to bolster what you say, Catherine, is that it's still a meeting with Donald Trump at the end. That not necessarily personalizing it in the way that Peter just did, but just putting us at the center of the story, and with his tendencies towards narcissism and anything else, which every politician has, but he's got a couple extra drops. I hope he doesn't lose the plot in that process. Nick?
If the U.S. is the ratifier of any deal, then that's making Donald Trump the ratifier of any deal. And I just can't quite see a scenario in which that moves us substantively forward toward peace.
What peace? There is peace. I mean, like, North...
Toward a more stable peace, a more reliable peace, toward a scenario in which when people get missile alerts on their phones in Hawaii, they don't think they're probably
true. You know what? That
true.
Wasn't Donald Trump's or Kim Jong-un's fault. That was a bunch of idiot, public people.
The underlying conditions in which people believed a missile alert might be true are fully Kim Jong-un's fault.
Okay. Then it's not Donald Trump's fault. And what do? You talk to Kim Jong-un. I mean, this stuff, it drives me nuts, because it's like, so don't do anything, do everything. Ultimately, what every American is going to say is that there can't be peace until Kim Jong-un is replaced and there's regime change, because regime change has worked really well everywhere else that we've tried it, especially in the backyard, literally in the backyard of China. That's not going to happen. The U.S. has a role to play. And it's like, the idea that people are flipping out, this is like, remember, the same people who are hostile to talking with Kim Jong-un were saying that the Iran deal was an absolute giveaway. It was worse than Neville Chamberlain, in Munich and all of that kind of stuff. And, it hasn't quite turned out that way, although we've lost interest or have any knowledge of what's going on in Iran. It seemed that the Iran deal actually worked to destabilize the regime there a little bit in a way that's good, because it was homegrown.
The problem, Nick, with that thesis is that Trump agrees with them on Iran because he found that to be useful in his
political campaign. He has done nothing. He has spoken broadly about it. He has done nothing to actually pull out of the Iran deal in the same way that he pulled out of the TPP or that he pulled out of the Paris Accord. So, this is the whole thing. It's like remember when everybody was worried about normalizing Trump? Like, we need to demystify Trump and realize he's a blabbermouth. He's an idiot in like fundamental ways. He is an embarrassment, not to the U.S., but to the borough of Queens, I would say, and to realtors who don't need to be more embarrassed by, people who do real estate deals. But when you start to push through his stuff, he's a lot more like other presidents. And, that is not a good thing. That's not a compliment. But we should kind of de-escalate our fears about him every bit as much as, attributing to him some kind of superpower ability to destroy the world because he picks his nose one way one day.
Catherine, let's re-escalate our fears by means of switching topics slightly and going to what we started with, which is a clip from Trump's campaign-style rally, which I assiduously ignored, having decided it was weekend time for Matt. But he said a lot of, Trumpy things there. But the one that caught my ear was the one we played about how, China dealt with the problem of drug addiction by executing drug dealers. And there's been actual reporting that he's sort of trying to figure out a way that we can go back to 1996 politics on that style of treating the drug war. And the real world implication beyond all of this, is it not, Catherine, publisher of a magazine that just did a great Jacob Sullen piece on opioids, is that Trump's basic concept about both supply and demand of narcotics, which is, I think, insane, but also his approach towards specific policies about drugs are actually hurting us, are they not?
Yes, they are hurting us. That is true. There's a couple different ways. First of all, this is not the first time that Trump has praised an almost cartoonishly hardcore law and order is like to call this approach law and order is to slander the law and order approach, because it's basically something that starts to walk closer to like execution squads with unlimited power. He's also said
it's like a violence and punishment approach.
It's a violence and punishment approach as opposed to law and order approach. He has praised the Philippine president, who is explicitly just sending out squads to murder drug dealers, as doing a great job. This is not the first time that Trump has basically said, like, hey, one solution to our drug problem would be to kill everyone. Now, I suppose you could argue on some level he is currently pursuing that solution, as Jacob Sullum's excellent cover story in the current issue, bingo, reveals. He is, you know, in this way just pursuing the same policy as his predecessors, but the combination of cracking down on street drugs and also restricting the supply of prescription drugs in the opioid family is killing a lot of people. And, you know, we can talk a little more, if you like, about the intricacies of how those two things relate. But the very short version is that if you reduce the supply of prescription pills, both for people who genuinely experience pain and were getting them from a physician who's now scared to prescribe them, and also you create a incentive for people who were using those pills to either because they're becoming more expensive or less available to move into black market drugs. And those drugs in turn are becoming more deadly because of some other factors, including the adulteration with fentanyl, that in fact, prohibition is killing people. It is killing lots of people and it is leaving people who legitimately need those drugs in
Peter,
agony.
You're from Florida. Florida is just based on doctors writing prescriptions for pain medication and Medicare pump and dumps. Isn't that true? But more seriously, can you sort of from your background, both in terms of Florida, but also a healthcare kind of policy wonkery, talk about that kind of nexus, treating those doctors in Florida like criminals, and is there something about Florida that attracts actual criminals to that? Or just shed some light on that, because Florida's a weird place.
Florida, the worst state, without any question. And I say that as someone who'd spent much of my life in Florida. You know, so look, Florida is a state full of Medicare fraud. It leads the country there in a lot of ways, which, you know, yay, we're number one. Florida also has unusually punitive laws for doctors who prescribe opioids and other pain medicine. And what has not just doctors who provide prescribe them, but also for people who sell them, who sell small amounts to often to undercover cops or to people who are working for the cops. And so they end up basically being kind of dragooned into being confidential informants, agreeing to either help the cops or take the maximum penalty. Lauren Cressai and CJ Sierra Morella did a story on this that was really sort of excellent and also kind of depressing, just looking at the ways that Florida's Florida's laws about prison time for pain pills have really ruined a lot of people's lives. And so, you know, these laws were passed and all of the state legislators were like, well, we're going after the big, the high level dealers, the guys who are bringing it in on their cigarette boats and, you know, in tons and in pounds, right? You know, the guys in the mansions in Miami. No, and what ends up happening is we went through and CJ and Lauren got the records. And there are a couple thousand people who are first time offenders who sold in most cases, a handful of pills, basically, and were locked up for 10 or 20 plus years. And so that's the sort of thing that Florida does and then calls it tough on opioids. Yet Florida also manages to be a kind of a hotbed of opioid abuse. These two things go together. They almost always go together. This is what happens under prohibition regimes. And right now we are living under a kind of an opioid prohibition regime in which we have decided to treat it as a criminal problem rather than as a pain and medical addiction.
Nick, we've been hearing about the opioid crisis or epidemic for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, it feels like. And the points that both Catherine and Peter make about the basic problems of prohibition here are grunting over there are kind of obvious. What I want to probe here is it my fault?
By the way, did you just put them down?
Who? What? The Peter and
Catherine.
Catherine
and Peter. Yeah, you just said the points they were making were kind of obvious.
No.
I thought you meant did he kill us like old dogs?
All of which are.
It's sad.
Spoiler alert: Old Yeller doesn't make it.
Young dogs with
Damn
blue
it.
Hair. When this first arose. Was it squishy libertarian a-holes like me? Is it our fault for not saying in every instance, yes, legalize the heroin right now, sons of bitches, well, because prohibition always sucks and opioid epidemic is BS from the jump and you're going to kill people? I feel like this we're making the argument, we're making it well, but like that didn't obtain 4 years ago somehow.
So are you arguing that in, I don't know, like 1975 when the cigarette smoking was still legal and there were cigarette machines in high schools, if we had said, you know, if only these cigarette machines also carried heroin, we wouldn't have a drug problem. Yeah, that probably would have changed the course of human events, Matt. I'm pretty sure of it.
Yeah.
You know, I think there is no question, you know, and as Peter and Catherine both pointed out, that prohibition doesn't make it any easier for people with substance abuse problems to come forward. We know that, you know, we know that with drugs, so-called hard drugs like heroin, so-called soft drugs like pot. And we know that with liquor from the Noble Experiment in the 20s and 30s. So that's, you know, that's a given. One of the things that we should be talking about here, or what we started talking about, was China, you know, Trump saying to China, oh, you know, I think it's fucking great that the guy who runs China, who just passed, through legislative process, the term limits that were in place on China, so that we now can have a new emperor of China as it becomes a world power. You know, that's all great. And that, you know, the way they take care of problems in China with drug dealers and drug users is just to kill them. I'm looking at a story online from 2015 in the New York Times, which talks about how China's rising prosperity means that they have a rising recreational drug use problem. And that, you know, it's split between heroin users and methamphetamine users, which makes a kind of perverse sense, especially if it's the same person. You know, you take meth in the morning to go to work and make a lot of money in a booming economy, and then you take
a lot
some
of towers
heroin
to build there.
Then you take some heroin, you know, at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, so you can get a couple hours sleep before taking methamphetamine again. The point is that,
you know, some of us just do this with coffee and like whiskey, and
pretty
it works
well.
Yeah,
it's
pretty
hard on the
well.
Liver, though. You know, to be quite honest. But if China is going to replicate the West's mistakes with drug prohibition, you know, that sucks to be Chinese, because they're going to waste an enormous amount of time and energy, and they're going to destroy all sorts of lives while also corrupting their police force. Trump, what we need to recognize, this is another case where he's like, oh, yeah, that sounds great. Just kill the drug dealers. You know, he sounds like Newt Gingrich. He sounds like Bill Clinton at various points. He sounds like Bill Bennett. He sounds like any number of echoes from the late years of the drug war in the 20th century. The fact is that Donald Trump is presiding over the end of the drug war in America. And we can push him as good libertarians, and we should, to move faster. But he was, with the exception of Bernie Sanders and Gary Johnson, he was the only presidential candidate last time around who was saying, you know what, pot legalization should be decided at the state level. Jeff Sessions, his execrable attorney general, has turned against that, but it's not clear that it's having any effect. So again, read through Trump's bluster and stupidity and see what's actually happening. The fact is that we have more states have legal recreational pot than ever before. Massachusetts is coming online in a couple of months, and there's only going to be more and more of that. So whatever Donald Trump says, he's going to be limited in what he can do, both in North Korea. He's not going to be able to say, hey, you know what, you guys take Seoul. OK, like, I don't care. I'm getting out of the hotel business in Seoul. Why don't you just invade South Korea? Like, he's not going to be able to get away with that. And he's not going to be able to get away with intensifying the drug war in America, because that battle has already been won.
I have found, for what it's worth, that the thing that makes people's eyebrows go up and they go, huh? These days, when talking about this stuff, is the direct correlation, and I think it's creeping over into causation at this point, with legal marijuana and medical marijuana, just the availability of that to be used as a medication or palliative, it has been correlating very strongly with a sharply reduced fentanyl and opioid deaths out there. So if it's possible to resonate with people there beyond just using the big P prohibition word, which should always work as well, that's also in the toolbox. I wanted to shift to trade, which we've also talked about here on the last couple of podcasts, but now we have it. We have the trade war that's easy to win. Was finally kind of announced and unveiled on Thursday, 1 week after Trump first announced it kind of ad hoc in a meeting. And I should point out that in the intervening time between that first, like, oh, you know, we're going to apply tariffs on aluminum and steel to the description of all that kind of stuff, a lot of people, including us, I'm sure, talked about all the how this is really hammering on the stock market. Stock market lost like 200 points in a week over this. Didn't really, not that you should live and die by the thing, but the Dow Jones Industrial Average was volatile, but didn't really like super tank as a direct result. I think there are other arguments against this stuff. But now that we have seen what this is in practice, which is we have 30-day windows apparently with China and Mexico to renegotiate here. I think South Korea, as part of their North Korea deal, literally the same guy who was announcing this stuff on the White House lawn was there to try to get South Korea exempted from the steel thing. So now that we know what this all looks like, what do we think about the tangible trade semi-war thing that we have on our hands? Catherine, I go to you first.
I think one element of this that's been the most interesting to me is the rapidly shifting rhetoric about whether small changes in prices or small amounts of you know, tax rebates or tax returns make a difference to Americans, right? So we've got, you know, the Secretary of Commerce holding up his can of soup like unto eternity forever somehow. We've got, you know, this question of like, well, you know, if it only adds, you know, X dollars to the cost of a car, it's basically fine. We have, you know, Democrats, of course, on both sides of the, you know, when my president cuts a check to American people, it doesn't matter how small the check is. It's a huge difference for the working class. And when Trump cuts taxes, you know, it's peanuts, no matter how much money it is. I think this sort of inability of people who are thinking and talking about tariffs to understand how much of an impact they're going to have is a huge problem, right? It's very easy to understand, hey, what if we needed to make a tank and we didn't have steel? We need steel here. That's a simple idea. But what if every single darn thing involving steel and aluminum is a teeny bit more expensive in a way that is impact, you know, has differential impacts depending on where you sourced your steel in the first place? That's a lot harder. And, you know, when you combine that with people's sympathy with Trump's general, you know, we got to get a good deal and right now it's an unfair deal. You know, I can understand why in general support for these tariffs is pretty high. You know, even my now dead to me hero, Elon Musk, was out there tweeting sort of in favor of these tariffs on the level playing field argument, which is essentially the Trump argument. It's not fair. So I guess I am greatly disheartened that these passed and they passed so quickly. I'm disheartened that they have general popular support. And unfortunately, the costs are going to be distributed enough that I doubt people will rise up when they realize their car is a teeny bit more
expensive. But Nick, if we if the stock market does dip this year, and I think it might for perhaps unrelated reasons of just the a huge amount of debt plus an increased cost of interest rates and borrowing might spook people out. And also, you know, there's a lot of different little mini bubbles out there, depending on how you measure and rate things. But my question to you is so if the economy goes south and we're humming along pretty good right now, will it not be, aha, that's the trade war's fault at that moment? And will there therefore be an available politics kind of teaching moment that can finally get the pendulum going in the non-stupid direction on economic policy?
No. I mean, that's pretty much the case. Obviously, the pendulum swings back and forth. You would think that Smoot-Hawley, which helped kind of lock in the Great Depression, would have cured the protectionism in the future. It didn't do that. This isn't going to do that. And I worry that Catherine is right, that people will, you know, feel the effects of this, but it'll be like a mild flu and they won't know where it's coming from. But, Trump is terrible.
And you always got to watch out for those initial flu-like symptoms, because sometimes they're the flu and sometimes they're like
cold age.
Meningitis.
Yeah, death. It's like it can become a real problem. The fact of the matter is Trump campaigned on protectionist tariffs. He was right there with Bernie Sanders, who was pulling for this. Elizabeth Warren won't fully admit that she likes anything about Donald Trump other than his hair, I guess, and his ability to read genetic codes of Native Americans at a distance. But she believes in all of this. She recently was on a bunch of yak shows talking about how tariffs need to be an essential part of our trade policy. Trump is awful on trade for all of the reasons that we know. He has started a bizarre war, which started somehow. China was dumping steel on us and aluminum. But since we already have high tariffs against them, because we're not in trading agreements with them the way we are with other people, he had to take on the rest of the world, except for Canada and Mexico. This is insanity. It's totally predictable insanity, and it follows directly from what he promised on the campaign trail. It is stupid, and it should be fought. Whether that's successful.
We also have this great piece. We have this great piece up today at the site from Eric Boehm, who has been all over the important sub-beat of how this will affect our ability to drink beer. And one thing that he has, he's got a quote here from the CEO of American Keg, which is the last American keg manufacturer. And he is saying that tariffs will inadvertently drive up the price of steel for him, that, he may not have a sustainable business. And this is exactly opposite of Trump's "we don't make things here anymore" philosophy, right? This idea that somehow a policy proposal designed to make America great is making it so that America can't put its own darn beer in its own darn kegs anymore. You know, I don't care who makes our kegs, but Donald Trump does. And so this is a great example. There was also Eric notes, and I think we should throw some numbers in here because you should always replace adjectives with numbers. A wise man once told me that the tariffs.
You mean a 90-year-old man?
Maybe, yeah. The tariffs, according to a policy brief that came out this week from the Trade Partnership, which is admittedly a pro-trade think tank, as you might tell from the name, the tariffs could grow the U.S. steel, iron, and aluminum industries by about 33,000 jobs, but they will wipe out about 179,000.
Right.
So that's 5 jobs lost for every job gained, which I'm pretty sure
that's a pretty good body count. If I can just point out again, Trump is acting exactly like Barack Obama did, who levied massive steel tariffs in 2016. Also did tires in 2009, where he basically lost 3 jobs for every job he claimed to save, according to most analyses. And Bush, of course, did this with Canadian timber and with steel. During the stimulus years, there was a whole Buy American thing in the very late Bush years as well as early Obama years. And it turned out that you had these great, stupid arguments where people were like, oh, we have to, in order to make America great again, we have to make Americans pay more for shitty cars. And so like the Jeep Patriot somehow seemed like an American car because it was owned by Jeep, which was owned by indirectly, by an American company, was actually made overseas and imported here, whereas the Toyota Tundra, which is an evil Japanese car, was actually basically completely made here. All of this stuff is horseshit. And one thing that we can say about Trump, he doesn't mean to do this. These are clarifying moments, because now you have a Republican who is going all in on economic nationalism, which is really more of a democratic trade union thing. He is exploding every possible category. And the thing that we need to do, I think, as good libertarians and as advocates for free trade and more open borders, is to point out all of this makes total sense from within that economic nationalist bubble that both Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump inhabit, and a bunch of Republicans. And it doesn't make any sense at all. All it does is drive up the prices and kill American jobs. Let's use this as a teachable moment.
Steve Bannon was out there in France over the past few days talking with his National Front comrades and saying that, you know, you have something you can teach Americans here. And one thing that Francophiles have been telling us about for a while now is that in addition to having all the kind of xenophobic nastiness that we've come to expect with the National Front, they are unsurprisingly also very in favor of tariffs, of withdrawing from any kind of international trade body, of protectionism, and of making sure that the welfare state is robust. That is the politics that they're all going for. Peter, I want to read you a quote from Peter Navarro, who's now the last economist standing, I think, in the White House, or at least the one who emerges dominant after a long kind of tussle over policy with Gary Cohn, who's
a night of the long knives, Matt, a night of the long knives, just like Hitler. Trump has gone through and decimated his own ranks.
In Bloomberg a few days ago, Navarro says, "This is the president's vision. My function really as an economist is to try to provide the underlying analytics that confirm his intuition. And his intuition is always right in these matters." That's what him talking about what he's doing to trade. Is there more than like a handful of gainfully employable anti-trade economists out there in the world that Trump has to choose from?
There's barely even a handful, because that trade is good is one of the things that economists, professional accredited economists, agree on most. And so to find somebody who tells Trump, who affirms him, his anti-trade ideas, you have to reach for folks like Peter Navarro, who literally says, I mean, what was that quote? It wasn't just that he's saying, well, you know, that Trump is right on trade. He's saying, whatever Trump thinks, my job is to provide ammunition for that, because Trump is kind of by nature inherently already right. It's the exact opposite of how a good policy advisor should go about their job. Now, look, it's one thing to kind of make the case for a policy you don't quite agree with in public after that policy has already been made. But there are stories out of the Bush administration when Bush was talking about steel tariffs that some of the policy advisors would go into the meetings and they'd start sort of just kind of casually talking about, well, you know, we don't really think this is a great idea economically. It's going to cost jobs. And Bush would be like, what? Because George Bush was not an economist. George Bush didn't have an economics degree, had not really spent.
Breaking news, yes, here, right? On the Reason Podcast.
So I probably should have put that in a tweet to an article first for the traffic, but we're going to do it here, folks. No, and so like George Bush kind of didn't know all of that. And so the job of an economic advisor, especially sort of in the pre-policy state when decisions have not been made yet, is to lay out, is to be an honest broker and to lay out the facts and sort of the best evidence for how these policies work. And Navarro is saying pretty clearly he's not going to do that. That's the kind of person who ends up being an anti-trade economist.
By the way, I realize that I'm boring through repetition here, or maybe by original insight, but let's not forget that Christina Romer, who was Obama's head of the Council of Economic Advisors, reversed her basic insight that made her professional reputation, which had to do with stimulus spending being full of shit, in order to trumpet Obama's signature plan, or one of his signature plans, which was the stimulus.
And I pointed this out repeatedly, but again, it is one thing to do that after the policy has been put in place.
Then resign. You know, pull a Gary Cohn and fucking resign. What I'm saying is that the idea that somehow Trump is unique because he has driven out all of the good principled people and he's not listening to his economic advisors, it, you know, which you see in the press all over the place, is just false. I mean, you know, presidents have attorneys general, they have economic advisors, they have a whole coterie of, you know, ass-kissing bootlickers around them, and they discard their advice and they discard them as people whenever they need to. And again,
what Peter's saying, Nick, here, and I think the distinction is, it is interesting and worth pointing out, is that Navarro's not even trying on the front end of it at all.
But that's why he was not brought in, because Peter Navarro is going to be like, God damn it, Trump, we got to reduce all tariffs. You know, it's like,
yeah,
he's
exactly.
A whore.
No,
he's been a shitty economist for his entire career. He's a joke in the profession. And it happens to good ones, too.
Another way to understand this is there was a great post on Slate Star Codex about a month ago where he describes, or Scott Alexander, which I think is not his real name, describes the idea that you can sort of see debates as a confusion or as a sort of a melange of people who want to look at things in terms of conflict and people who want to look at things in terms of mistake. So this whole conversation about trade, we're sort of predicating it on the idea that each side thinks the other side is mistaken, and so they're offering arguments to correct that mistake. They think, okay, the right argument, rightly phrased, will bring the people on the other side over to my point of view. I need only to figure out the right way to do that. The conflict theory says basically that people identify with teams, or that they're looking for an authority, or that they need somehow to use that rubric to decide when to engage. And I think Trump is pure conflict, and you know, most administrations are a mix, and in fact Trump is a mix as well. I shouldn't say pure. He's just
Trump himself is pure conflict,
much further down the conflict spectrum. And I think that's what's a little bit different here, that all presidents obviously have yes men hanging around them. That is the nature of power. But the extent to which any conversation in the Oval Office can be a mistake-based conversation, in which you can say, like, okay, we're just trying to figure out the right way to think and talk about this so that we can get to the right answer, versus the right answer is somewhat irrelevant in the face of the much broader societal and perhaps even existential conflict that we are in, where we have to sort of keep our team intact, whether our team is Republicans
so
or America.
I think that's worth kind of exploring a little bit more, because it's a different framework to view how Trump acts and also previous presidents act. But how does that map onto the gun debate? Because this is, it's a genuinely fascinating moment after the Parkland school shooting. Trump tacked into the center and said, you know what? Yeah, like, bump stocks, that's stupid. Let's raise the age of guns. Let's do a bunch of things that had NRA spokespeople as well as gun rights enthusiasts flipping out. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, so I think...
And then he retreated from it.
That is interesting. And it's an... Right. I was going to say, I think it's an example where Trump engaged on the mistake level. He said, oh, maybe this debate is really about sort of figuring out solutions and determining correct facts. And everyone, as you say, either freaked out or got excited about that. But then the reaction gave him the feedback that he should have been approaching this as conflict, not as mistake. And he has since
stepped back and said
the age caps are not going to happen. The bump stock thing continues to kind of founder, whether or not he's now saying, oh, we got to design body armor for teachers and think about how exactly to write those rules. So he retreated back into the mistake, into the conflict framework after a foray into mistake, which is, I think, part of the reason everyone got so.
He had an interesting tweet this morning right before we started taping, trying to kind of address, why is it now that they've taken back off the table, or they're not proposing in their gun proposal that they announced in the White House last night, raising the age limit from 18 to 21? He said, you know what? Still, I'm paraphrasing here because it's not in front of me, still kind of interested, but man, the politics are not there for it right now. And, you know, the action is going to happen on the state and local level. Let's see where things shake out. There's a lot of strong feelings about this, but the national politics aren't there to raise which is interesting. Like, we don't necessarily always think of Trump in terms of, oh, hey, look, he's responding to political conversations, but he made it pretty explicit on his Twitter feed. I will add one last drop here before we get to our closing topic on all this, just to sort of the weigh in on Nick's side of general free floating annoyance about life and the Obama administration. At the beginning of the Obama administration, in particular, there was this very strong notion of, well, you know what? at least this guy here, unlike the predecessor and his lying liars, he really cares about having the math all add up. He's going to have, you know, some real
He's a Vulcan, Matt. He's a Vulcan. He's a cool, calculated, no drama, you know, outer space alien, man. But born in America, for sure.
His first budget was called, like, a return to fiscal responsibility and all this kind of stuff. And people still were operating under that delusion for, I don't know, the first 18, 24 months. Many people still do, I presume. But once you started looking closely at the Christina Roma heel turn was spectacular. But I was hardly the only one. It turned out that, like previous administrations, it's about politics. It's not about the Vulcan mind hold. Speaking of Vulcans, we are going to our end of show. What are you consuming right now? Which I presume, in terms of Catherine Mangu Ward, is going to be pure Vulcan robot porn. But I'll let her start this off by seeing whether I'm right or wrong.
You know, I actually was like sitting here waiting to see whether your Vulcan pivot was to me or to Suderman.
Because
it was kind of 50-50, to be honest. So my what I'm consuming is actually a physical item this time around. Last night, Tariff T-shirt Twitter happened, and let's just all pause for a minute and enjoy that is a thing. Everybody's favorite trade economist, Scott, I can't say his last name,
Lincecum, I believe.
He's at Cato.
Sorry if we mispronounced that, Scott.
He is just on fucking fire for the last couple of weeks on Twitter. He has lost his mind in the best possible way. And last night he mocked up a T-shirt that looks like a slogan T-shirt, except for it says on it in giant block letters, "Tariffs not only impose immense economic costs, but also fail to achieve their primary policy aims and foster political dysfunction along the way." It's just written on the front of the T-shirt. So I bought one in gray. I'm going to be wearing it at all events henceforth. There's another version of this T-shirt coming out, though, if y'all want to wait, that has a dead weight loss graph on the back demonstrating this point in visual form. So, you know, that's yet more of the glories of capitalism. You can have two versions of your tariffs are bad T-shirt. I am getting it from Amazon. It should be delivered tomorrow. Hallelujah.
I just want to second that before we get into mine, because I also bought one in red from my phone using my thumb, and it was just a great experience.
Peter, we got to coordinate so we don't both wear it on the same day, because that would
red
be
and
really
gray.
I really want to wear them on the same day.
Matches up very nicely.
One.
Yeah.
Peter, finish your consumption.
I'm watching Homeland season 7, and I don't know why. It's the show was promising, interesting, and not always didn't. But even when it was sort of better, it didn't always work. But there were some good seasons there. I think seasons 1, 4, and 5 in particular were basically together. But we're now 7 seasons in, and it's just like every Showtime show lasts far too long in this season. So one of the interesting things about this show is that they, you know, it sort of tries to maintain a contemporary relevance. The last season was mostly shot and written before the election of Donald Trump, and it basically it dealt with the election of a Hillary Clinton-like sort of very hawkish woman president. And then, like, Donald Trump was elected, and they sort of reworked that season on the fly. And that season they had intended for it to be the end of that arc. And now, because of Trump, and because that last season dealt with an internal plot by the National Security Agency or the CIA or both or something to use fake news to take down the first female president on Twitter or some nonsense. And they were working directly with a guy who's not named Alex Jones, but is really just Alex Jones. And like, so they've decided to now continue this. And it's just like the dumbest possible, like, sort of a twisted inversion of today's politics. So the last couple of episodes have featured a Waco style raid on a white nationalist compound. And now there's sort of like the ensuing protests, and it's sort of reflecting off of the Charlottesville stuff. And it's just like they don't they are demonstrating how little they understand about actual politics and also about how to make an entertaining and
so
thrilling show.
It's a no from you, but you will finish the season?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely. It's on right after Counterpart, okay, which is great, and I can't bring myself to turn off the television.
Nick,
for a
save us
hour.
From Peter.
Oh man, I did watch the OJ.
No,
the
can
OJ,
do.
Did OJ confess special that was on Fox last night, which was fantastic for those of us who were alive when OJ was doing the low speed chase up the 405. But I'm mostly consumed now with Sneaky Pete, which is an Amazon Prime original starring Giovanni Ribisi as a con man who gets let out of – he gets out of prison. He takes on his cellmate's identity, who he belongs to a family, a fucked up family of bail bondsmen from Bridgeport, Connecticut. And he ends up in assuming this guy's identity, gets into bigger trouble than he was trying to get out of by assuming the guy's identity. It's in its second season on Amazon streaming. It's excellent. It's wonderful. It's co-created and produced by Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad. And it's a really intense kind of wonderful show about cons, con men as well as convicts and like the dark side. I won't say of the American dream. It's a very compelling, kind of suspense thriller show.
So better than Homeland.
Yes. Almost had me sold. Keeping in my tradition of consuming music from 1970. I'm literally consuming music from 1970. I occasionally like to use my ample spare time to do things like pretend the Beatles never broke up, and what album would they have released in December 1970 based on all of their solo works from that year. And that requires a kind of a deep listening of a lot of both great stuff in the case of George Harrison's All Things Must Pass and some real dreck in the case of Ringo Starr's
The
two
Coup of Blues and Sentimental
two
Journey.
Solo records.
I don't know why this pursuit seems less Vulcan-y to you than
I know it doesn't.
Don't come easy, though, Matt, does it?
Yeah, that's a beautiful song. Easy. That's the 1971 record. Don't preempt me.
And it was written by George Harrison. He's seen rehearsing it and writing it in the Let It Be documentary.
Yeah, a lot of the what's interesting is the same players
solo,
play on different guys' solo records, and that's all fun. But I just wanted to point out one song off of Boku of Blues, which is a country record. Ringo Starr went down to Nashville in 1970. He could do anything he wanted in that world in life, so he made a kind of a bad country record. And the last song is called Silent Homecoming, which is this sort of like quasi-gripping tale of a returned Vietnam soldier. So before anyone tells you the Beatles weren't political, no, Ringo Starr was singing bad country songs about Vietnam homecomings in 1970, and that's just enough weirdness that we can all grapple with. And with
peace,
that,
peace.
Peace and love.
Love and
love
peace.
And peace. Yeah. So thank you for listening all. Stay tuned for Reason Podcast D throughout the week, in which we do a lot of interviews and other things. Nick is behind the helm for a lot of that, and it's great stuff. I would preview what's happening on our platforms, but I'm just not going to do that because Catherine already did that a lot already. Just go and make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while we're there. Have a great week.